This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. As a kid, Vivian Howard never imagined her future in her hometown of Deep Run, North Carolina. In fact, she swore she'd leave and never come back. No, Vivian envisioned a much more metropolitan life. She wanted to work in journalism and live in New York City. And she made it to the Big Apple. After a short time in advertising, though, she decided to chase another ambition. She thought she might want to work in food, and so she took a job as a server. After a while, she worked in the kitchen, worked her way up from onion peeler to cook, and then Vivian made a name for herself in the Manhattan restaurant scene. But guess what? She did come back home.
So this is my life, raising twins, living in the house I grew up in, and exploring the South, one ingredient at a time.
Vivian now runs one of the most popular restaurants in the state, and she is the star of her own reality TV show, A Chef's Life, airs on PBS Sunday nights at 7:30. We're going to talk about the restaurant and the show, all of that today when we meet Chef Vivian Howard, who's with us right now. Welcome to the show. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Tell us about growing up. It was a tobacco and hog farm, right?
Yes.
Deep Run, North Carolina. Tell us about that.
Well, I grew up on a tobacco farm, and pretty much everyone around me was also on a tobacco farm. That's what we did in eastern North Carolina, and I thought that's what people did everywhere. But I from a very early age, always kind of dreamt of moving away. I wanted to order Chinese food and have somebody bring it to our door, and I wanted to drive somewhere. I wanted to walk somewhere other than to the car. And so those were my dreams.
Well, but these are big dreams for someone who, as I understand it, thought that Kinston was kind of the big city, and you had a little bit of an inferiority complex about the highfalutin folks at Kinston. Am I right?
Yes. I mean, we would on Saturdays get dressed up to go to town, and we would go shopping. And I went to a county school versus the city school, and I always felt I had an inferiority complex, I guess, based on growing up in the country. We were, you know, river rats and rednecks.
What did you think was going to happen to you when you went to New York?
I don't know. I think it was too much for me to even fathom. You know, I did have some interludes between the country and New York. So I learned that Kinston, in fact, was not the big city I thought it was.
What about cooking and food? What was your introduction or your sense of food growing up? Were you very interested in it, or was it that's just something you did? You ate?
Well, I always loved food, and I grew up in a family that really appreciated eating. Unlike a lot of chefs, I did not grow up at my mom's, hip cooking alongside her. But I always, you know, was the first in line at the buffet table, probably, and we lived in a community that was very close, based on our family church and neighbors and relatives. And so we would share food during the summer. There was always a sack of new potatoes on the front doorstep, or pickles or preserves that someone had made, barbecue chicken on the weekends. So eating was very important to me. Cooking, not so much.
You, as you said, it wasn't Deep Run to New York City. You stopped along the way, including boarding school. Tell us about that experience. That was in Raleigh?
No, I went to my first boarding school was Salem Academy in Winston-Salem. And after that, I went to Virginia Episcopal School. It's where I graduated from.
And is that when you, I mean, I'm wondering, too, when you got the sense that you would not come back to Deep Run. Was that kind of always, or was it after you left and made, you know, could compare it to other cities and other places?
Well, when I left, I definitely had in mind that I was not going to move back. And once I got the taste of Winston-Salem and the largest mall in the state.
That'll do it. That'll change you forever.
Change me forever.
What about food? Because at some point then I think you wanted to become a food writer, right?
Yes.
Had thoughts about journalism. When did that take root?
Well, writing was always this thing that I did, and people told me I was good at it, so I wanted to be a writer. I don't think I really loved writing as much as I loved being told I was good at something. I went to NC State for college and majored in English language, and spent some time in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and had to develop a course of study there. And I chose to study the country's food via food and culture. And there I became really fascinated with all levels of dining and really made my whole trip there about the country's food. And at that point, I was very, very interested in food.
I was going to ask you which came first, because there are a lot of ways to study culture. You chose food ways. So you were already interested, or that was mildly interesting and then became sort of deeply interested once you looked at those food ways?
Well, food was my way to connect with that country. It was the most comfortable way. My Spanish language skills were and are terrible. I actually would pretend that I was deaf on the bus so that no one would speak to me because I didn't know how to respond. So food and eating seemed to be the only thing I could really do well down there.
So that was journalism and writing. Did you figure you had a career in, was it in food writing, or did you think about other forms of journalism? What were you thinking at the time?
Well, while I was in Raleigh, I spent some time at WRAL and decided that I wanted to be a television news journalist. And I got an internship at CBS News in New York for one summer, and I was the CBS Sunday morning intern. And so I kind of thought that my path would continue in that direction. So at that time, food writing was not even something I understood to be a thing. But journalism in general was where I wanted to go.
Did that take you to New York, that internship?
Yes. I spent the summer after my junior year in college in New York that summer. And I got my Zagat guide and went about eating at every cheap place in that book and writing my own little reviews.
Actually, I think they have even bigger malls there than Winston-Salem.
They do. They do. The whole thing.
Everything. So what was that? What was that experience like for you? You're thinking about journalism. You're thinking about how great this might be as a profession, but also the big city. I mean, were you hooked at that moment?
I was. I loved it. I loved the energy. You know, I lived about 50 blocks from where I worked, and I would often walk home and just take a different route every time and just look in all the storefronts and eat. And again, much like Buenos Aires, food was the most comfortable thing for me in New York, and it's the way that I kind of explored and discovered.
We are exploring the chef's life with Chef Vivian today on The State of Things. Talking about how she came to create the TV show that is now in its second season on PBS, filmed right here in North Carolina, based on the restaurant that she started and had been going for 6 years in Kinston before the show started. So tell us now about your move into food and the food industry in New York.
Well, I was working in advertising, and this is during the time that 9/11 happened. And after 9/11, a lot of folks... I noticed a lot of folks around me kind of quitting their jobs or deciding to go in another direction with their careers. And so I was very unhappy at my desk job. And so I decided to quit and figure out what I was going to do with myself. I was going to write. Well, I did not write. I looked for a job, and I had worked as a server all during college, and so I had experience there, and I got a job as a server in a restaurant in the West Village that just by chance, the concept was Southern food via Africa. And for me, growing up in Eastern North Carolina and always eating just food, I had no idea that what we were eating was, in fact, could be categorized as a certain type of food and that there were stories behind it. And so this whole experience working at this restaurant and learning from the chef there really opened my eyes.
What was it? Tell us more, because that is an important part of this, and I think on the food scene now, is the story, the fact that you can find the story and tell those narratives around food that just makes it all that much better. And you say you were a little bit surprised to realize that you had a narrative, the stuff you grew up with, you can actually create a story around. To what extent was it the food, and how much of it was the story that sort of pulled you deeper into the food industry?
Well, at that point, you know, this restaurant was just opening, so all the servers, we took a 2-week-long class on the concept of the restaurant and how to be servers. And so the chef, lectured to us for days on end about the type of food we were serving, the stories behind it. And I was just blown away by his storytelling and the fact that the grits that I grew up eating were grits and that they meant something.
Well, so stop right there. What's his story behind grits and how does he sell that to a Manhattan audience?
Well, my story behind grits was, Uncle Ben's instant grit package in front of cartoons on Saturday morning with some Velveeta singles sprinkled in. And his story was, stone ground, Anson Mills, heirloom grains, and the fact that grits were, in fact, poor people food at one point. It was a porridge. It was a way to stretch the meal, to fill your stomach. And the fact that it was a very important grain, and you either ate grits or potatoes or rice, and the grain on your plate in many ways defined the person that you were and where you came from. And so that story was really, it got me off my chair and got me really interested.
Well, we'll talk more about that. The two stories, the story you grew up with and the story you brought home to Kinston, is our conversation with Chef Vivian Howard of Chef and Farmer Restaurant, and the public TV series A Chef's Life continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, talking with Chef Vivian Howard of Chef and Farmer in Eastern North Carolina and the public TV series A Chef's Life, talking about your decision then to jump into this whole industry, this business of making food. So the good news about being at a restaurant, the restaurant where you were in the West Village in New York, was that you learn now that there's a story and that can really encourage people to come to your restaurant. Now, the downside of being that close is you're close to the kitchen. Was there anything discouraging about seeing how the sausage is made?
Not at all. I mean, having grown up on a farm, I knew where our meat came from, for sure. And I was very interested in what was going on behind the doors in the kitchen. And I had really connected to that chef and the stories he was telling. And I wanted to learn. I still had this idea of myself as a journalist. But I knew that I felt at home in the restaurant. So I thought that I would try to work in the kitchen and translate that experience into a career as a food writer, which I now knew was, in fact, a thing.
Were you encouraged or discouraged as a woman, or as somebody who is maybe competition from doing all? I'm looking for the Kitchen Confidential story. You see that, don't you?
I never felt that. I'm sorry to disappoint.
That's our show, folks. Thanks for listening. were you encouraged then?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's great.
That whole Voyage restaurant experience was incredibly encouraging, and the chef encouraged me to come in and learn and work for free. Anybody's going to encourage you to do that, though, probably. And so I learned a lot there. And at that point, I decided, okay, I really want to get into one of the city's top restaurants right now. So at the time, I felt as if you needed to go to a culinary program in order to get an internship of the sort.
And you did. Tell us about that.
I did. I went to a six-month program at ICE, which is Institute of Culinary Education, and had my sights set on this new, very avant-garde restaurant that was opening at the time called WD-50.
And you did. And you ended up working there.
Yes. I became the lowest peon of the peons there in the basement, peeling garlic and onions, and eventually worked in pastry and then garde-manger, which is the cold part of the kitchen.
Did you learn much? Can you learn much peeling onions in a place like that?
Absolutely. Kitchens are interesting places, and there's a whole etiquette that's very, very specific there. So peeling onions and garlic, I learned about kitchen etiquette and professionalism and how to conduct myself in a very top-of-the-line rated restaurant.
What is that? It's kitchen etiquette for someone who's peeling the onions. What did you have to keep in mind every day?
You need to keep your head down and your mouth shut and pay attention to what's going on mm-hmm. around you, because there's lots of things you can learn. But know your place. I've often heard it compared to the military.
So there's a real hierarchy, and you'd better pay attention to the stripes. That all makes sense. So at a certain point, you decided you wanted to you wanted to start your own restaurant. Am I right? Was that while you were there at WD? Was it 50? Right.
Yes. Yeah. Well, no. At that point, I was still just trying to learn how to cook. So you know, this restaurant, they were doing very experimental things, and I was still kind of learning the basics of cooking. So in a lot of ways, I was in over my head there, but I was still trying to figure out where I belonged in the food world. So I worked there, and then later I became part of the opening staff at one of Jean Georges' new restaurants at the time called Spice Market. Mm-hmm. And I was enjoying all this because I felt like I was good at it. Again, people were encouraging me. And working in a kitchen is very much like being on a team. And you all work together for a common goal. And I enjoyed that. I had never played team sports and had never kind of had that feeling before. And that continues to be my favorite part about working in a kitchen.
The other eye-opener must be that, you know, it's a little bit about making that pork come out juicy and tender and fork tender and all of that, which is a technique. And then there's plating and presentation and the storytelling. I mean, you're having to absorb all of this, I guess, all at the same time.
Yes, and the storytelling part of it was always my strong suit. And I deem myself kind of creative. That was something I was good at. But, you know, there's a lot of parts about working in a kitchen that did not come really naturally for me. You know, kind of keeping my mouth shut and my head down. I was the youngest of four girls and was always kind of the person entertaining everyone in my family. So this was a new role for me.
Oh, not a lot of idle chit-chat. Well, at a certain point, you did decide to start your own restaurant, and you let that be known back home, and that's when your parents came up with a plan.
Yes. Ben, my now husband, and I had some offers to help us open a small storefront centered around soup and sandwiches in Manhattan. And when my parents caught wind of the fact that we might actually put down real roots and stay there, they were just traumatized completely and offered to help us open a restaurant in North Carolina. And wow. At the time, we were led to believe it was anywhere in North Carolina. So I had my mind on Asheville and, of course, Durham, but
You looked at Wilmington, too. So these are great places for Asheville, Wilmington, Durham, great places for food.
Yes, but yeah. It turned out it was Kinston.
Well, so did you look in those places, though? Did you go and kind of scope them out, or did they bring you back and say, oh, we meant Kinston all along? How'd that go?
Well, when we actually relocated to Eastern North Carolina, it became very clear that the restaurant needed to be in the region, in Eastern North Carolina. So we did look at Wilmington. We looked at Greenville. We looked at Goldsboro, all cities that are bigger than Kinston. But truth be told, Kinston's bones, the buildings downtown and the infrastructure really spoke to us. And we felt like it would be the best fit for us.
I still want to know your initial reaction when your parents said, we'll help you, but you got to come back home.
Well, I said no. And my husband, Ben, who's from Chicago originally, said, this sounds interesting. And I like Lenoir County. I like Kinston. I like Deep Run. And so he was up for it. And I said, you know what? I'm going to remind you of this for the rest of your life.
Because there's some things you should know. Well, so you get down here. Now, when did the idea of the chef and the farmer, the kind of the farm-to-fork restaurant that you've created, was that always in the works, or did that come to you a little later?
Well, initially, we were going to open much what we had plans to open in Manhattan, which was a soup and sandwich shop. And this part gets kind of fuzzy because I can't really remember what the train of thought was. But we decided, or I should say, I wonder if Ben's listening right now. I decided that our community needed a nicer restaurant, a place for people to celebrate special occasions. And yes, our goal was always to use local farmers for our produce and proteins. You know, when I moved away so many years ago, our region was a place full of small farms, and when we moved back, it was very different. And we, from the very beginning, wanted to be a part of making Eastern North Carolina a place for small family farms again.
Ben is on the line from Kinston. Ben, go ahead with your question. No. But that also raises sort of an interesting possibility, because if you're going to try to hold yourself to a kind of local produce as much as possible in your restaurant, it does create some limitations, which you talk about on the show. Let's listen.
What we do here is farm-to-fork or farm-to-table food. We work with a number of small farmers, all within 30 miles of the restaurant, to procure our produce and proteins. That's a really popular concept these days, and in theory, it's a beautiful thing. In practice, it can be really challenging. For one, you know, you have to change the menu every week or every day based on what's coming in and what's coming out. Cooking seasonally, I know that in July, for instance, we're going to have a ton of corn, butter beans, tomatoes. So I can work within that framework and really try to make those ingredients shine.
Yeah, you actually made butter bean hamburger, butter bean burgers, I guess. That was pretty cool. So it's the challenge of coming up with the menus, but also I think working with farmers too, who had not been in the habit of working with a local restaurant. How did those relationships come about?
Well, the relationships have kind of grown and been fostered over time. But that is absolutely a huge challenge, because a lot of restaurants, you know, work with one, two, or three vendors. And we have really like a 30-person vendor list. And you almost need one person to just manage the relationships and see what the best menu options are for that coming week. So, you know, there's a lot of little idiosyncrasies about the farm-to-table relationship that people don't think through.
Well, farmers, too. We think of small farms and little vendors and, you know, farmers sort of farming their stuff out or selling their products. But they've gotten in the habit of making a contract with a big industrial producer. And so the idea that somebody's going to come take part of it is difficult for them, too, right?
Right. I mean, you know, farmers are trying to farm.
Right.
And they're trying to make sure that things are right on the farm. And I'm asking them to deliver what it is I want to buy to the restaurant. So, you know, there's lots of challenges for both the farmer and the restaurateur that we as a group are trying to figure out. There's lots of farmer co-ops now where farmers come together and they can work together. There's one in our region called Feast Down East, and a group of farmers will come together and have a product list, and they work together to make it easier. And I really think that is what we're moving toward to make this a successful movement.
Well, it's kind of amazing when you think about it, because we're having to remember a sort of agriculture that none of us really – I mean, you talked about having your grits came from a package of Uncle Ben's, right? And yet there's this vision of good old Southern home cooking. It's still in the minds of, I suppose, the folks who go to that restaurant in Manhattan. They're imagining these folks down there just kind of peeling their corn and then shucking and making the grits from scratch. But it gets back to the sort of the old days of industrial agriculture when selling good food meant using Southern voices, but also moving us in. Do you remember this? You remember this commercial? Let's listen.
Mother, why isn't my fried chicken this crispy and juicy? I want your recipe.
Grandma didn't fry.
But it's crispy like fried.
Can I tell? It's shake and bake, and I help.
And I help. There you go. So we move us off of that. So what? Talk about that, having to kind of relearn a cooking that we've become associated with, but in fact didn't really grow up with.
Right. I mean, just as I said, I grew up eating grits out of the package and then the microwave. But, you know, I'm just one generation away from the folks who, you know, did cook grits the slow way. And so we're lucky in that there's still folks around to share those cooking traditions with us. And I think we're on a swing back toward preserving some of those traditions, at least learning what they're all about.
That said, when you open a restaurant like yours that's going to be experimental and use some of those ingredients in different ways, are the folks who grew up with, you know, sort of canned soups and packaged grits ready for that restaurant?
Well, I think our restaurant and its food has been well received because it tastes good. You know, and they don't care if we're back there with our own stone grinding our grits, you know, as long as what they get on their plate is tasty and comforting and balanced and pretty, because you go to a restaurant to experience something different than you would at home. So we've been able to make it work in that way. But, you know, there has been a fair amount of, I'd say, education on the floor of our, in the seats of our restaurant.
Well, and it's interesting too, because part of when the tobacco economy crashed here, we had the Golden Leaf Foundation. Some of that money was in fact used to help farmers get out of commodity farming, tobacco, and into food production, and then develop the market so that people could once again enjoy the good food that their grandparents and great-grandparents took for granted. And you're the beneficiary of one of those grants, right? Your program.
Right. A Chef's Life, for our first season, received a Golden Leaf grant in order to help educate the market and make them interested in fresh fruits and produce and proteins, and also help people understand how to use them again. And I think we've been successful in doing that, or at least being a part of doing that.
Yeah, it's just so important to be able to relearn those skills from a health point of view, the idea of getting families together, spending more time making food, eating healthier food. As you say, you sell it through taste. Once you taste it, I don't have to know any of the rest of that to know that this is the way to go. But it is good to have all those other side effects, better nutrition, better family life that goes with it. Today on The State of Things, I am talking with Chef Vivian Howard. That conversation is happening right here on The State of Things. She is the owner of a restaurant in Kinston and also the star and host of the show A Chef's Life on PBS. Well, how did that show come about?
Well, about 4.5 years ago, I was invited by my neighbors to make collard kraut. And I, at the time, I had never heard of collard kraut, but I felt sure that I knew everything there was to know about Southern cooking. So I was intrigued to go out and spend the morning with these gentlemen, all of them older than 60, making kraut with collard, something they'd done their whole lives, using the same seed that they'd always used. And, you know, they had all this folklore surrounding the way they make collard kraut. You can't make kraut when the farmer's almanac says the moon and the stars are in the sign of the bowels. Women never participate in making collard kraut. You know, they had all these rules to follow. And I was just blown away and felt as if there was a lot of storytelling to be done in Eastern North Carolina surrounding our foodways. And so I went home and talked about this incessantly with my husband. And he said, please call someone to see if they want to help you tell this story. So my friend Cynthia Hill, who's a documentary filmmaker, also from Eastern North Carolina, I called and proposed the idea, and she was up for it.
Well, first of all, I want to know what happened when you, a woman, made yourself present at the collard kraut festival or the goings-on, which apparently had excluded women up until then. Did you cause a stir?
Well, women could watch. We just couldn't touch the collards.
Wow. So this was a men's thing. And the idea, and that's kind of interesting, too, because now we know fermented food is becoming popular again. So it's lost some of the stain that canned food once had. How much about actual Southern cooking? Where did you learn the rest of it and about Southern cooking? Because, as you said, you know, you weren't really at your mother's hip growing up. Where did you learn about Southern cooking?
I did a lot of reading and I did a lot of question asking. You know, my mother's mother and my father's mother were both great Southern cooks from different schools of thought. You know, my mother's mother was very much a vegetable cook, and she gardened and she believed in healthy Southern food. And my father's mother was, you know, a Southern cook who believed in her pork fat and, you know, putting some bacon grease on top of her collard greens. So I learned through my parents' storytelling and a lot of reading and just exploration, I guess.
Canning is a very important part of that culture and the lore. Is it something that's important to you and what you do at the restaurant?
Well, I actually learned to can via the show. I learned how to put up tomatoes 2 summers ago from Mary Vaughn. And since then, I've become absolutely obsessed with canning. My husband said, you know, I'll come home from work you know, 10 o'clock at night and start canning stuff. And it's a little bit ridiculous, but now I have this obsession with canning, but I don't want to open any of the jars and I don't want to give any of them away. I'm like a hoarder.
Well, what's the secret to great collard kraut?
Well, you need to make sure that you're not making kraut with collards until there's been a frost. I would say that's the number one rule.
All right. Does that make them a little sweeter, a little bite?
I think it makes them a little sweeter, a little more tender. Yeah. And really, you think about eating greens like that in cooler weather. So I think that that plays into it as well.
Well, that all sounds good. And as far as the moon and the stars and their alignment, you're on your own.
Yeah, I really think that's just a myth.
It's just something for the guys to talk about. My guest this hour, Chef Vivian Howard, chef in the Farmer Restaurant in Kinston. The public TV series is called A Chef's Life, and we will talk more about that program and much, much more when The State of Things continues. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking with Chef Vivian Howard of Chef and the Farmer in Eastern North Carolina in Kinston and the public television series A Chef's Life. So now you've got Cynthia Hill, as you say, a documentarian, has done a number of terrific documentaries that we've talked about on this program and have been distributed nationally. She was a friend of yours. You said, help me document these cool stories. How did that become A Chef's Life?
Well, we had the idea to, from the beginning, to have it based on ingredients and tell the story of those ingredients based on the farmer who grew them, the traditional application of them. And then somewhere along the way, it became also what I did with them in the restaurant, kind of a modern application. And so that it kind of just grew out of that. Neither one of us knew how to make a food show or a cooking show. And Cynthia actually, I think, started watching the Food Network to just even see what that was all about. But I think because we had no experience in that realm, it made what we were able to do very unique.
Well, one of the many programs that kind of stands out to me is the Buttermilk Belt, where you learn how to make a traditional biscuit. Let's hear a little bit from that program.
Being from the South, people would automatically assume that my mother and grandmother made these amazing buttermilk biscuits, and I grew up eating them in the morning and on weekends. But unfortunately, that is not the case. I grew up eating canned biscuits and loving them.
Just come on over here.
Don't we need a measuring cup or something?
No.
Okay. Today we are at Warren's house making biscuits with Lily Hardy. She's the daughter of Mary Vaughn, who showed us how to can tomatoes earlier in the summer. And she's going to school me.
Are you ready?
And were you? The biscuit is a mystical food. As he suggested, you don't need measuring cups. I've never had anybody who can successfully explain or teach how to make a biscuit. Have you?
It's definitely, there's an art to biscuit making, and there are so many different types of biscuits out there. I was asked to write a recipe for the biscuit we made on the show, and you absolutely cannot do it. You can write about a method, you can write about the tools you need, but it's really, you know, how big is your biscuit bowl? What is a biscuit bowl? How big is your palm? What's your lard like? What is your flour like? It's about the look and the feel of the dough. And so there's no way, it's something you have to be shown.
Yeah, and it's, as you say, the size of the bowl with respect to your palm. For instance, Lily's bowl, was that handed down? I mean, she must have been using that for a long time.
I think she might have just pulled it out of the cabinet there, but she's made enough biscuits that she could probably take any bowl and own it.
Well, so let's talk about this, the rise, first of all, of cooking shows, the fact that they have gained so much popularity, the stories that go around them. But how much can you teach? How much real knowledge about cooking do you think it's transmitted in those shows?
You know, I'm not sure. I used to watch a ton of cooking shows, and I appreciate them because I think it's made people have more interest in cooking and in food. But, you know, I think that you learn by doing, and if you're just watching the cooking shows and not cooking, then I'm not sure how useful they are. But I also think cooking shows have taken a different turn of late, and every time I turn on the Food Network or something. There's some sort of competition on. And for me, cooking is just not, that's not what it's about.
Yeah, that does seem, I do have an opinion about that. And I've never really appreciated that part of cooking or the screaming and the yelling and the tension, because it does seem to me about bringing people together and not driving them apart. That is kind of weird. But on the other hand, if you have a restaurant, for instance, I mean, you, in a sense, you are in competition. You're in competition with every kitchen in Kinston, right, and any other restaurant around. So you have to think about that to some extent, I guess.
Right, and restaurants are very high pressure machines. Really, you know, every diner's situation, every diner's experience is an emergency. You know, from the time that they sit down, we're trying to win their affection. We're trying to make sure that they have a wonderful time and are willing to come back. You know, so in that way, restaurants definitely are high pressure, and I can understand how a sort of competition has grown out of that. But for me, the food experience, sitting down and breaking bread and cooking and preparing, that's not what it's about, for sure.
Anyone I know who's ever started a restaurant talks about how difficult it is and how much of a challenge it is to really stay with it. It's very time-consuming passion to keep a restaurant going. How did you balance that with then creating a TV show to go with it?
I get asked that question a lot, and I do not have a great answer for it because I'm trying to balance it. You know, we have a lot of moving parts, a marriage and two 3-year-olds in the mix as well. And every morning I wake up trying to figure out how to make all those parts work. One thing I do know about being a mother and being a chef is that I'm always feeling guilty. You know, if I'm not at the restaurant, I feel guilty because I'm not at the restaurant.
So like when you give your kids SpaghettiOs because you're too busy at the restaurant.
No, I never do that.
Come on, just
you know,
once.
It's really more about time spent with either group, you know.
Yeah. Well, is there anything about doing the show that actually informed what you do at the restaurant? I mean, does it in some ways help?
Oh, for sure. With every ingredient that we've studied on the show, I've learned so much more about where it comes from, how to grow it, what it takes to get it to the plate. I've also learned traditional applications of it that I thought I understood, but I definitely did not. So I've learned a lot from the show. And interestingly enough, the show is not something that's taken me that far out of the restaurant, because so much of it does involve being in the restaurant.
Right, and working with those local farmers. In fact, can you give us a sense of, because the show is kind of seasonal, you work through the seasons to give us a sense of what it's like to cook with the food that's available. What, for instance, now you're moving into, you've already taped, I assume, season 2. Give us a sense of what we can expect.
Well, in season 2, you know, with every season of the show, we've only made 2, but we try to span a year so that you can have some summer ingredients, fall, winter, and spring, so that you feel like you're moving through the seasons. So in season 2, you know, we started out with blueberries, and then we have shrimp. We're going to see butter beans, which are one of my favorite southern ingredients. We see turnip roots and turnip greens in 2 separate episodes. The turnip has never gotten so much love, I'm sure.
The lowly turnip. The turnips are they're great food, and again, they're often overlooked, and you know, folks have turned up their nose until they've had some really kind of cool recipe.
Yeah, my hope is that I'm going to shine a very sexy light on the turnip, and we do a lot of cool things with the roots. And we talk about something that we call run-ups in our region, and that happens when a certain type of turnip plant has overwintered, and at the first sign of spring, greens run up from what appears to be a dead turnip plant. And it is every old-timer in eastern North Carolina's absolute favorite type of green to eat, and something my mom is absolutely obsessed with. So we went on a run-up turnip hunt.
Do they appear everywhere you grow turnips, or is it only selected plants?
It's a certain type of turnip plant. Huh. And, you know, even when we were trying to get to the bottom of what a run-up turnip was, there was some issues doing that. So there's some misinformation out there. And it's one of these things that If we don't tell the story of the run-up, it may disappear with my parents' generation.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about going to farmers markets and having everybody from farmers to chefs to customers interested in this is that we are eating different parts of the plant. So ginger and then baby ginger and then the leaves from baby ginger, which can influence soups and do all kinds of things. So we're actually getting more economic. I mean, even though, sadly, because of incentives and subsidies by the federal government, what industrial food looks a lot cheaper than it is. So it makes this other stuff look expensive. On the other hand, we're getting more economical. We're using more of it than we did with the old industrial model. So that's kind of cool, too.
Right. Yeah. We just shot a beet episode for season 3, and I learned how to pickle beets from this gentleman in our community. And he pickles his beets by leaving the grains on there and boiling the whole plant and then just pickling the root. And for me, as a chef, the beet grains are one of my favorite things of all time to cook. You know, they have that earthy flavor that a beet root will offer you. So, you know, even someone, you know, old school like that was not cooking the beet greens. So the fact that we're using the whole plant and in such diverse ways, I think is very good.
And blueberries, you came up with a blueberry barbecue sauce?
Yeah, you know, a lot of times when we're dealing with summer bounty and fruits in particular, sometimes those fruits get away from us and we don't have the most perfect specimen. Maybe they're a little old or bruised. And making vinegars is a great way to use those fruits, cobblers too. And so we made a blueberry vinegar at Chef and the Farmer and then turned that into a vinegar-based barbecue sauce, very similar to the style that Eastern North Carolina is known for. And I grew up eating barbecue chicken rather than having a pig picking every weekend. And so we decided to put that on chicken at the restaurant. And it was really kind of the marker for us in determining the type of food that we would continue to cook.
Now, is that the kind of thing that is practical for us to do at home? Could we do it if we find ourselves with a superabundance of blueberries, or take a lot of time?
You could. And, the easiest way would not to be to make a vinegar from scratch, but to take blueberries and vinegar and a little sugar and cook those together and then process them. And then you would have something that you could then turn into a barbecue sauce.
The other nice thing about that is then we don't have to use those processed sauces that have all kinds of corn sweeteners in it and what other kind of stabilizers. You can do it from scratch, spend a little bit of time, and it's a whole lot healthier and could create a unique flavor.
For sure. And, blueberries are incredibly healthy. So if you can, for me, my kids love this blueberry barbecue sauce. And so I'm trying to think of ways all the time to trick them into eating things that I want them to eat.
How about shrimp? What's your favorite way to cook shrimp?
Shrimp is one of these things in a restaurant. It's like if you put shrimp in something, it's going to sell. It's going to fly off the menu. So we use shrimp a lot. And in our new restaurant, The Boiler Room, we have a peel-and-eat shrimp that is just outstanding. And, you know, we put this rub on it. And when you're peeling the shrimp, you get the rub on your fingers. And then you're eating the shrimp with your fingers. And it forces you to lick your fingers. And I like that.
We are talking today with Chef Vivian Howard on The State of Things. She is the host of her own TV show called A Chef's Life on PBS. And since the restaurant has been going for now, you're in your seventh year?
We're in our ninth year.
Ninth year. Oh, so you were going 6 years before the TV show started.
Correct.
That's right. So you're in your ninth year now. Who comes to the restaurant? By this point, folks have heard about you. What percentage of folks are from out of town and curious? And how many of the local folks in Kinston eat at your restaurant?
Well, we have a very passionate local following. And, you know, if we did not have those folks, we never would have made it. But at this point, I would say between 75 and 80% of our clientele travel to eat with us.
That's kind of cool, too, because then you realize, I mean, they may all be from North Carolina, but one of the things I think your show highlights is the diversity and the bounty of North Carolina's agriculture. This state produces a lot of good food, and I don't know how it compares with other states in terms of variety, but it's pretty spectacular, isn't it?
Yes, and this time of year, you know, fall is, I think, often overlooked in terms of produce, but it's really one of my favorite times of year to eat and cook in North Carolina. You know, you've got beautiful greens, turnip greens, collard greens. You've got sweet potatoes and all your winter squash. So I love the fall.
You are thinking about making a Christmas special, I understand.
Well, I'm not thinking about it. We filmed our Christmas special last December. So it actually takes place all December of last year. So it's real. They actually spent Christmas Eve and Christmas Day with my family. So you see all the Howards up eating sausage biscuits Christmas morning and opening presents. I'm nervous for that part of it. But
why?
Well, you know, Christmas morning, we probably were not all looking our best.
See, you got, what I'm hoping is that you've got like little Santa hats on and bells ringing, but that while you're singing Christmas carols, there's a hog on a spit just dripping into a fire, no?
You know, if I could, you know, make it the way that my imagination would have hoped it would have been like that. But no, unfortunately, you know, life gets in the way. And we're not wearing any Santa hats.
Okay. Well, that's the other thing. When you do it for TV, now let me ask you this, because do you have to kind of reconstruct a Christmas that you never really had? Or was it a lot like what you remember growing up or what you do now?
Well, kind of the idea around the holiday special was now that I have children and a house, that we would act like regular folks on Christmas and put up a tree and try to establish some Christmas traditions of our own. So you kind of see us on that journey.
Chef Vivian Howard is the chef at Kinston's Chef and Farmer. She is the star of PBS's A Chef's Life. You can catch new episodes of A Chef's Life Sundays on UNC TV. It is carried all across the state, 7:30 p.m. And in fact, you're carried in all of the big markets, and just about every public television station across the country carries the show.
Right. For season one, A Chef's Life aired in 95% of the country, and we expect that season two will be at least that.
Sounds great. So if you missed all that, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org, and find out how you can watch the program or learn about anything else we talk about on this show that is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is our news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.